So hi, it's really good to finally connect and to meet you, at least on video and over the phone.
Yes, thank you so much for talking with me. I'm very excited. Obviously, I've read quite a lot of your work and I really admire it, especially God and Proof. Being the new person here, I have some questions. Would that be all right to start there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got questions for you too.
All right. Well, I'll start you off with an easy one then. I hope that you'll take some mercy on me as well. But so I've read your essay on Agamben and Highest Poverty, and as it is, pretty shortly, I guess Pope Francis is convening kind of a summit to talk about the use of money and property. And he actually, in the article that I read, that's sort of introducing the summit, rehashed the quote that you quoted, that empty convents are not ours, they're for the flesh of Christ, that is, refugees. So, sort of broadly construed as the apostolic way of life, monastic living, which I think Peter the Venerable explanation of it. What do you think that there is in that way of living for families, not just individual people, but actually for, groups that are already coherent, trying to gain something from the monastic way of life or the apostolic way of living?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's great because it's kind of unresolved right now. I mean, the monastic tradition is in some sense in a kind of crisis these days, and in another sense, in a moment that could be one of great revival. It's kind of an interesting time. You know, in 1950, people were pouring into monasteries and convents and committing their lives to a certain kind of celibate, traditional mode of being, and you know, they're just pouring in, and that's not happening anymore. These places are emptying out. The kind of old form is having trouble surviving, and at the same time, there's a craving for a lot of the stuff that goes on in that tradition represents. There's a craving for contemplation. There's a craving for you know, an alternative way of life that doesn't privilege consumer goods and all the stuff that we spend so much of our time working around. And so I think it's a moment where we need to kind of reconsider that tradition. And I think one way of doing that is to consider the roles that families might play. And here we can look at examples even just within Catholic communities, like the Catholic Worker, which in Catholic Worker houses often include families and people raising children, as well as Opus Dei communities, for instance, and groups that you know, some in some ways seem more traditionalist, but actually are really innovating new forms of community life within the Catholic Church. And then also the traditional monasteries themselves are often building lay communities outside the monastery, where people who are inspired by that way of life can participate. So I think it's an open. I think it's an open field, really, and a moment where lots of experimentation is possible. Is it something that you've encountered in your faith, this monastic tradition, especially the kind of in your engagement with the political resonances of Catholic faith?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so definitely a lot of the theology that we have about property comes out of the conflicts. Basically the big knockdown dragouts that went on between monastic orders and the remainder of the church for a while there. Certainly those things aren't inherent to the life of the church or even the history of the church. Certain political tensions put them at odds with one another. The next question that I have actually
Well,
surrounds
just
that.
I just got to say on that question of property, I was just rereading Benedict's Rule, you know, which is a kind of guiding text for the Catholic monastic tradition. And there's one section; it's about a paragraph long on monks holding property, and it begins with this amazing excoriation of the evil practice of property holding. It's really an amazing, very radical text that probably a lot of people today would be surprised by.
No, absolutely. And the very careful divisions that were made between the holding of property and the use of property and the sort of, Roman legalistic tradition had given them the idea of dominum as being essentially, you know, identical with the holding of property, that you could dominate and control property. But the Franciscans were actually very sensitive in how they came in and made divisions between, well, you know, you can have legitimate use of something that's not dominating it. And that theology, I think, is very, very useful in conducting sort of analysis of contemporary politics, especially because we tend to kind of conduct ourselves now in proprietary terms. Every argument you hear floated out there is going to have to do with somebody's property being compromised in some way, even in kind of unexpected areas. So, you know, for instance, the abortion debate, you'll hear people say, it's my body, it's my property, or with the, it's my body with the implication, therefore it belongs to me. And in some sense it's separate than me, but it is mine and it can't be intruded upon. Or when the sodomy laws were up for argument in the courts, they would at least be couched in language of what goes on in my home, in my bedroom, is my business. So there's a deep proprietary trend in how we do politics, which I think you're very right would be a little bit in conflict in a lot of ways with the very anti-property position of a lot of these older texts. So actually, one of the major Franciscan objections to private property ownership was that dominum, which they equated with ownership, kind of predicates unequal power relationships, that you can't really get around property having that effect over power relationships between people. Mm-hmm. So how would you contend with that in a world in which we do manage so much of our political lives that way, in a proprietary mindset?
Well, I think one very kind of simple and clear approach is to reclaim this concept of the commons. This is something that is kind of taking hold, I think, in a lot of different circles these days. It's really striking to me to see that this language of the commons, communization, came up across the country among people who were involved in the Occupy movement, kind of after the heyday of the movement passed. So around mid-2012, people in New York, and I was just out in the West Coast and learned that the same thing happened there at about the same time, kind of independently. People started kind of thinking back to what they had experienced in the protest encampments and started thinking about this concept more generally of the commons, of what is held in common, and of having a more robust sense of what our society chooses to hold together communally and govern democratically, to have more and more of our, to see more and more of our resources as things held in common, which in fact they are. You know, we see such kind of disastrous misunderstandings and losses of the commons when particularly property is able to trump environmental commons, you know, which are so clearly a part of what we share, the atmosphere, the air, the water, the landscape. And yet these things are able to be bought and sold. And so I think just reclaiming that sense, which I think was modeled in the place of the cathedral, for instance, in the center of a Catholic city, that this is a thing in common, that our most beautiful building is something that we hold together. I think this is something that's very deep in our tradition, and it's an opportunity for our tradition to offer something to speak to a craving that I think a lot of people have.
Yeah, absolutely. The notion I often hear repeated in the work that I do in property is that you're actually most yourself and most fully human, in a sense, when you are acting with other people, holding things in common. So even the act of holding something in common as a community and maintaining it in common and reaping its fruits in common, in a way expresses you much more honestly than if you were to hold things individually. And I wonder how you feel about the increasing tendency to kind of constitute all of our relationships in terms of property. You think that's ultimately going to be a destructive tendency, or will it be mediated by something, or just speculate kind of wildly?
Gosh, it's ridiculous. It's I mean, it's crazy. Relationships are relationships, not ownership. And it leads towards slavery. I mean, if that's the case, and I'm not, you know, in some cases I can see what you're saying, you know, where you're talking about possession over, you know, over certain kinds of relationship. But I think in a lot of cases, the challenge that people are trying to face is one of freedom, is they're trying to hold in some balance that question of freedom, which is also an important part of our tradition, and not one that's always been practiced so well by our tradition. You know, it's a tradition that is grounded in a kind of free will affirmation of faith, though in many cases, societies have been built that haven't really given people that choice. And I think people fall back on this sense of property, on what's mine, every man and his castle or whatever, because they are seeking some kind of freedom from what I think can be really genuinely oppressive social situations. And so, you know, whenever you're talking about what's held in common, there's also that balance of autonomy, responsibility, but also autonomy and freedom, and that people really do need to have some domains in which their free will and their decisions are playing a role, and that's a real challenge too.
Right. It reminds me of the idea you bring up of the every man in his castle being sort of a refuge from a society increasingly in which things that used to be reliable are not reliable, in which relationships that used to be reliable are no longer reliable. We do seek, I think, and this might be shot a bit from the hip, but I think that we do seek to reduce commitment in pretty much any way we can these days. Everything is intended to be kind of short-term or temporary, or you should have the ability to turn around and leave it if you want and start something new. And that can be a very good thing. In the sense that, as you say, it gives people a great amount of freedom over, you know, how they self-actualize. But at the same time, it also makes other people a kind of risky proposition. And so you're left with the things that you can control being the things that seem the most real and reliable. And it reminds me of a William T. Kavanaugh essay. He called it The City Beyond Secular Parodies, which might be a little heavy-handed. But part of his argument that interested me, that I wanted to bring up with you, is this idea that in the kind of Lockean labor mixing sense, the way that things become property in the first instance is we do some work to them, and therefore, because we have imbued those things, the land or whatever object, with a bit of ourselves, it becomes like us. And in that sense, our rights and privileges are extended to it, and that's why we can defend it from other people or expect the state to intervene and defend those objects from other people. But William Kavanaugh argues that, and I think quite rightly, that is a bit of a reverse of what we're expected to do spiritually as Christians, where instead of the things becoming like us, it's probably a better avenue to grace that we become like God. And the example he gives is the Eucharist. And not the example, but in fact, the final instance of that is through the Eucharist, we become more like Christ. But do you see other spiritual correctives to that way of thinking, in which increasingly we make things like us and extend our rights to them and then isolate ourselves in that way?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the use of the word dominion, for instance, right? I grew up in Virginia, the old Dominion, so that word has a kind of certain funny resonance for me there too. But when people talk about the dominion that God gives human beings over the earth in Genesis and the creatures as well, it's come to mean such a strange thing. It's come to mean we have this kind of oppressive control over the earth and we can do whatever we want with it, which is so odd when we consider what dominion might mean for God. I mean, what would God's dominion mean? Play around with it and profit off of it and get whatever God wants from it. I'm not sure about that. I think a word that is useful to kind of add to dominion that helps us understand what that might mean is stewardship. Is that we're granted stewardship with the earth to the extent that we have power over it and we have the capacity to affect it. I think we can lose a sense. We can lose stewardship if we don't treat it the way it deserves to be treated. And I think that's an important part of property. Thinking about property too, and it's one that's in our tradition. That misuse of good things of the earth and misuse of anything that we might claim to have control over or power over. Should mean that we no longer have the right to it, that we don't have the right to abuse the good things that are given to us, and so I think we need to bring that word into the mix too. And this, for instance, is also a way of thinking about property that Gandhi articulated when he was thinking about a kind of nonviolent society. He replaced property with stewardship, that okay, you can have the things you need. Everyone's entitled to meet their needs and to have stewardship over the things that enable them and their families to produce the things that they need in order to survive. But you are not entitled to way, way more than you need to survive. And you're not entitled to things that you abuse and that harm the common good. And kind of along these lines, and also in the moment that we're in, you mentioned Pope Francis earlier. I'm really curious what you think about what your kind of general outlook on the direction of things in the church is right now. I mean, you're looking at it also across an ocean from the U.S. I'm curious. Do you feel excited? Do you feel like something fundamentally different is happening right now in the church? Or do you feel it's kind of like more of the same, but with a slightly different flavor? Or what are you feeling?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that Pope Francis is striking people in a way that other popes haven't in a while. And which is not to say that he's heterodox or unorthodox or anything like that. In fact, he's pretty popular with the little enclave of radical orthodoxy folk here at Cambridge. He's obviously. I think the people who are responding as though he's revolutionizing or reforming in a kind of untoward way are maybe jumping the gun a bit. On the other hand, I think the fact that we are seeing such kind of bitter resistance from certain quarters suggests that there is something different going on. and you never know about bitter resistance from certain quarters, because bitter resistance from certain quarters has a lot of roots. It could be actual resistance to Pope Francis' ministry. I think more likely it's resistance to how happy people are about it and to how happy certain people are about it. So when you see leftists, especially, I think, this is kind of an ugly tendency, but I think there's a certain set of people who see secular leftists get excited about what's going on in the church and say, well, that must be a bad sign. If the kind of heathens are pumped about it, there's a huge problem that we need to really keep a close eye on and be censorious about. And I don't think that's necessarily the healthiest reaction. If people outside the church are excited about it, I think that's fantastic, because, it obviously invites them in. And that's a huge part of Pope Francis' ministry is evangelizing. At the same time, do I think that this is sort of like a radical turn to liberation theology? No, I don't see it. I don't see it being a complete an upending of anything. In fact, I think it's a great renewal of things that have always been a part of our tradition.
I think it's, I mean, you mentioned liberation theology. I mean, for instance, the Pope just, welcomed Gutierrez, one of the fathers of liberation theology, to Rome. But I think in some ways it's a kind of rebalancing, a sense that okay, maybe there is something of value in this tradition, which spoke to so many people and speaks to so many people about the role of the poor in the church. And I also, at the same time, maybe Pope Benedict and Ratzinger had some fair criticisms to make about it. And there's a conversation to be had here. What I think is so refreshing, at least with regard to liberation theology, for instance, and actually so many things, is that a kind of balance might be being restored, where before it was either or, you're either with us or against us. The church feels like a kind of bigger tent, it's a place where conversations can happen again in a new way. And you know what you mean, what you're saying too about non-Catholics, I find, you know, really meaningful as a person in a interreligious family. Most of my family isn't Catholic, and many of my friends are not. It means a lot to see a figure like this who speaks beyond the borders of the church and who's kind of come to play a kind of Dalai Lama like role, you know, as someone who speaks, you know, the Dalai Lama doesn't just speak to Buddhists, but he's somebody who expresses some of the richness of his tradition to people who aren't a part of that tradition. And I think that's good for everybody. At the same time too, I think it's really important not to get too messianic about this. And Francis would be the first to say that. And you know, on so many levels, a pope is still a human being. And I think the real renewal of the church that I would love to see, and I think is kind of always being called for by our tradition, is one in which the people participate, when it's not just a leader giving us a new set of rhetoric, but a real renewal of participation and engagement, where people fill their church with the Spirit from the ground up.
Right. And I mean, even the dissent within the church, I think, is pretty exciting on a lot of levels. I mean, obviously, this isn't the first time there's been dissent within the church. And I can see a lot of the arguments being very healthy. And certainly Augustine thought that unity was ultimately important. But at the same time, if there were good faith disputes that produced further truth, then they were ultimately salutary and positive things to happen within the church.
I mean, compared to the Middle Ages, this is nothing. We don't have like three popes in three different places at war with each other.
As far as I know, this is
relatively mild, despite, you know, some of the really tragic and you know, horrible things that have been going on.
Right, and I think that one of the things that is so excellent about Pope Francis is among the many criticisms that people have forwarded about him, I have yet to hear anyone say that he's operating in bad faith, aside from like complete well-known nutcases like Rush Limbaugh. I haven't seen anyone say in a considered fashion, I think this is motivated or bad faith. Which is a great place to start argument. The idea that we're all arguing toward the same end, that we're arguing in fraternity, rather than in a sort of, you know, acrimonious opposition. And like you're saying, it's nothing on what we've seen in the past. I mean, it's certainly, nobody's been burned or anything yet. So ultimately, I think that it must be leading in a great direction.
Yeah, I hope so. Though, you know, even if there aren't literal burnings, there are people who have been so tragically hurt by the church, and you know, in some ways, I sometimes feel like my ability to stay with it is partly in the fact that I didn't grow up in it, and that I was able to choose as an adult a bit more what I wanted to pay attention to. You know, it was so striking when I was teaching American religions courses and in graduate school. We had an assignment where students were asked to tell a family a history, a personal history from their family. And so many of them were stories of leaving the church, of feeling hurt by the church, feeling oppressed by the church, feeling let down by it, that it wasn't living up to the ideals that it in part instilled in them. And so there's a long way to go. And I think it's really important to be humble about that. But you mentioning Rush Limbaugh makes me want to raise the questions of the politics of what Francis has been saying. I've been really enjoying your engagements with the attempts of the kind of political right in particular in the United States, but in general, attempts to map Catholic teaching onto particular policy proposals. On this question of compatibility, what kinds of politics is Catholicism compatible with? How would you begin to answer that question?
I think it's a strange question. And I think that in a lot of ways, it's not dissimilar from the subject that's raised by students writing about leaving the church. Mm. And so there are certainly, I can imagine, and I don't think anyone needs to do a lot of great work of the imagination to come up with very serious and almost unforgivable abuses that have taken place within the church. The sex abuse scandals, you know, scandals, kind of a cheap word to use there, but the crimes that were committed against a lot of children, immediately come to mind. And there have been other cases of the church definitely, really, really abusing the power, that it has in people's lives. Not as an inherent, you know, it's not inherent to the church that it must behave in that way. On the other hand, oftentimes as a pretty young person myself, when I talk to people who have left the church, it's basically because there are rules that they don't like that are advanced by the church. And these are usually matters of like sexual ethics. Mm-hmm. And so you can tell already in the mind, there are two philosophies. They have the rules that they're hearing from the church. And the framework of thinking about sexuality and, you know, human life writ large from the church. And then they have another alternative that they're thinking about going with, because they don't leave and go out into sort of wild nothingness. They don't become nihilists and say, you know, maybe there just aren't values. They say, no, I'm just mm-hmm. electing this other set of values that works better for me. It's more pleasing to me, which tells you they already had bought into it because they're operating in a kind of utilitarian frame. So it's a slow, subtle thing that I think works its way in from how we talk about politics in part. And then they leave the church and they go with this other set of thoughts, which usually is a kind of moral therapeutic deism or something like that, or that allows you to say, I'm going to go with the ethics that, you know, suit me, that make me happy, that allow me to operate in the way that I want to. And the political question is much the same. It says, well, we have the church over here, and it has its way of doing things and its way of thinking about economic institutions and markets and distributions. And then we have this other one that also works for us. And how do we make them compatible? Well, I mean, that, you know, so already I would say that I could really seriously question why you have this other set of values anyway. What is it doing? What is the kind of, maybe, you know, I think usually it's a kind of liberal tendency. And I don't mean that, I mean, I know that you know this, but I don't use liberal to mean like Democrats or however Ann Coulter is using it. That's not what I mean by liberal. I mean in the sort of classical liberal or neoliberal tradition. So why I would ever need to take that set of values that tells me how to think about good and bad and, try to map it on to what I'm getting out of Christianity, like there's some sort of incompleteness, is a question I would immediately raise. And that seems to be the kernel of the issue with thinking about compatibility, is why do I have to presume that there are moral defects within Christianity, basically, that there is there some kind of gap that I need to fill in with the kind of liberal political tradition? I don't see that as being there. I think that's what's so upsetting about Pope Francis, is with his apostolic exhortation, he was willing to speak to things that people are not used to having spoken to by the church, like markets and distributions, and willing to say these should be subject to the judgments of Christianity, just like all other institutions created by human hands. And that's sort of jarring to people who are used to kind of switching over into another ethical framework to consider those things.
Yeah, but there's a... In some ways, you could look at a lot of moments in the church's history as kind of adjudicating this compatibility issue and recognizing that maybe the church as such, temporarily in the world, the kind of church ruled by Rome, full of bishops and cathedrals and certain forms of architectural and musical expression, right, is not in itself a complete system. And to me, this is bound up in the word Catholicism, the universality implied by that word. That universality doesn't mean the church knows everything and therefore it encompasses everything. In a sense, it means that the church is open to everything, and the church can touch everything and can engage with everything. You look at a moment like what Thomas Aquinas represented in his time in the late Middle Ages, where in some ways you could describe his project as one of claiming the compatibility in a certain sense between Christianity and Greek philosophy. He was meticulously bringing Aristotle's ideas and modes of thinking to bear on Catholic Christian tradition and showing that they could speak to each other and actually that this philosophy would enliven and enrich this tradition. And this goes way back to early church and engagements with also Greek philosophy, but other forms of literature and experience, adopting rituals from pre-Christian forms, non-Christian forms. And we see this question too coming up today when people who are Christians also want to do yoga or want to learn from Buddhist meditation. And so there is some sense in which there is an attempt to do compatibility and to say, okay, where does this non-Christian tradition map onto the Christian tradition? How can it actually enliven and enrich our Christian tradition? But at the same time, and maybe this is what you're pointing to, or maybe not, you can tell me, there's a sense in which you need to really have a genuine dialogue. And with Aquinas, he was not just adopting Aristotle uncritically and slapping a Christian stamp on it. He was adapting Aristotle and deciding among Aristotle's ideas in light of Christian tradition and creating what he meant to be and what many have found to be a kind of richer synthesis.
Yeah, I mean, I think a genuine dialogue is important. And I think it's also important to distinguish between, you mentioned Christians wanting to sort of benefit from yoga or Buddhist meditation or something like that, or Buddhist styles of meditation. I don't think that there's any immediate problem with that. Even Paul, writing to the Romans, says, you know, you were able to see the truth and you turned away from it. So even people who aren't operating in an expressly Christian frame, even by the most strict Orthodox standards, are able to grasp truth in the world. It's just that in the Christian frame, all truth, all reality emanates from God. So even if you're a non-Christian, if you happen to upon a little bit of truth, if you happen to kind of unearth a nugget of truth, you have unearthed God. You have unearthed God's act in the world. You haven't unearthed something that is not of God that now has to be mapped onto him. You have actually happened upon something that is already touched by grace. And I think it's important in distinguishing between sort of cultural traditions and styles of practice of worship. And we could even fold in styles of politics there, because I do think, and I'm emphatic about this, I'm not emotionally wed to process. That's really not my game. So I'm not someone who says the only political process that's ever going to be just is X, is socialism, is communism. I don't think that's the case. I do think it's the case that when we're talking about ethics, what our politics are for, what they're supposed to be doing, why are we doing this politics thing? Why are we building markets? Why are we creating distributions with our political systems that put wealth in certain places and kind of concentrate it there? The ethics of that, the direction it's going in, the telos of it, must be Christian. There's no way that you can work out saying that our groundwork ethics need to come from someplace other than Christianity, at least, and say that you are a Christian politician, which, to be fair, those are the only people that I take exception with. If you're saying that you're not Christian and you don't really care about it or something like that, then I mean, I guess I accept, obviously, that your ethics are going to come from some other place. But if you're a Christian politician who in some sense puts a lot of their eggs in that basket, and then you seem somehow to be surreptitiously pulling ethics that suit your project from another framework, I have to qu- question why that is. And I guess that's what I was getting at with my compatibility piece. And it's something that comes up, that's come up very frequently in discussing, you know, economic policy, I mean, and welfare especially.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier radical orthodoxy. Maybe it would be useful I'd be curious to know, maybe you should summarize it for people listening, and then tell us a bit about what it means to you and why you've engaged with that body of work and you know where it fits into your way of seeing things.
Well, I hesitate to summarize something that is still inchoate in a lot of ways, that is still I wouldn't say it's over or anything like that. You still have quite a lot of scholars who are kind of working to form this tradition, but quite basically, I see it as a critique of liberalism, which is summing up a lot. But it's questioning the way that we see Christianity in the world. In a lot of ways, Christianity has kind of been maybe pushed off to the margins, or if you don't want to think about it as having been pushed to the margins, it's been individualized and internalized and sort of relegated to sort of modes of internal orientation or personal private practice, but thought to basically only have any kind of effect in those spheres. I think that Christianity has in a lot of ways seen a transformation from a kind of totalizing life orientation to a kind of self-help philosophy. Like, oh, I have these personal pathologies. I'm maybe lazy or gluttonous or something like that. So I'm going to turn to the strategies that Christianity gives me to try to fix those things about myself to be a better me. But right. That's, once again, a very inward-facing Christianity. And political forces that don't want to respond to the political, I guess, call of Christianity, that don't want to respond to the ethics of Christianity that would dictate how we should build states or structure distributions, have really taken advantage of the fact that Christianity has kind of undergone a transformation like that. Yeah. So radical orthodoxy is obviously much bigger than that. There are scholars of radical orthodoxy who look at art and culture and sociology. I'm focused on political theology, so that's sort of the piece of it that I zero in on. And to me, that has been the aha moment was that, you know, I think that it really does make a lot of sense to say that everything is constantly touched by grace, that we sort of inhabit a gift, that creation is a gift and existence is a gift and ongoing life on earth together is a gift. And therefore, participating in God's will for it is not going to be shut up in these kind of little boxes like, well, it's Sunday between 10 and 12, so now is my time to do Christian things and be a Christian person. But when I go to the voting booth, then I'm voting with my pocketbook, and it's about how much money I can keep in my pocket, and so on and so forth. It's about kind of breaking down those barriers, which have been, I think, superficially and externally imposed on Christianity.
Yeah, and it's so important to recognize the ways in which people's ways of absolving themselves from politics are themselves political, and this limitation, this constraining of religion to a kind of non-political personal development sphere is such an incredibly political activity, and just one very simple way of seeing it is just how much money is made through these efforts, and then how attention gets directed and redirected in the process. And a great book for me on that has been the last published book by William Stringfellow, an Anglican Episcopal lawyer and theologian, called The Politics of Spirituality. And he was asked to write a book about spirituality for a series about spirituality. And he just spent the whole time making this point again and again in very rich ways about the ways in which our spirituality is always political, and we need to account for that. We need to invite the political into our spirituality, inviting others into our spirituality. And you know, one thing that in my own experience was really kind of striking to see is that was that in some ways in my, you know, development as a Christian, you know, I was baptized when I was 18. And then I started working on this book, which became God and Proof, where I tried to explore attempts to prove the existence of God in some ways, to try to prove the existence of God to myself. But actually, it wasn't until working on in the process that led to my second book about the Occupy movement, where I had to put that faith to work in engagement with other people, think about and try to live out its consequences for politics, that spirituality really came to take hold, and that so often for me the proofs of the existence of God that really work, that register, and that feel real to me are the political ones, are the ones where people are showing that that reality of love in the world through their actions and through their relationships with others. Only then do the kind of logical proofs start to make a little more sense.
Right. It's like Aquinas says, you have to have faith and then you can learn, rather than learning so that you can have faith. Yes. And I think that one of the great gifts of radical orthodoxy is to say the political has a place in the order of things. So one of the responses that I often get from critics of mine is, you know, you're really politicizing Christianity here when Jesus wasn't really political. So right. Obviously that's like deeply unschooled in a lot of ways. And Candida Moss has, you know, I think she was on Bill O'Reilly's show when he broached that with her, and she just sort of immediately made Swiss cheese of it, you know, and rightly so. But, you know, even if Jesus hadn't had any commentary on politics whatsoever, the example of Christ is a political one, and politics and the state has a place in the order of things. It's a producer and a distributor of penultimate goods. It's not a producer of ultimate goods. It can't give you salvation. It can't produce utopia, and that should never be the intent, because it's going to be a failed one, and in some sense, I think, an idolatrous one. But that's never the goal of radical orthodoxy. The goal of radical orthodoxy is, let's produce the most useful, the most Christian, the most faith imbued political situation that we can, as an avenue towards ultimate goods.
Go ahead.
I mean, and I was just going to conclude with, I think in sort of right wing American politics, there's a real difficulty articulating exactly what the state is supposed to be doing here, in terms of ethics, in terms of ultimate or penultimate goods.
Yeah. And it's a, I think that the way in which people don't see the politics of, for instance, the ministry of Jesus, or of Christianity in general, is partly a result of our impoverishment of our sense of politics, of what politics can be. You know, you look at the politics page of a newspaper, and it's like elected officials and people trying to become elected officials and elected officials trying to stay elected officials. It's this very limited glimpse of politics, which can mean, and I think should mean, in a kind of much more broad view of like human relations, adjudicating power relationships. If the politics page included that, it would include much more about popular movements. It would include many more names that aren't quite so familiar, but stories that are actually much more interesting and dramatic and dynamic than what the official Democratic and Republican elected officials are doing, and I think that would be really valuable, and we would see also the ways in which Christian politics is always kind of undermining, digging at any foundations that try, and any attempts to build a kind of firm foundation around a political party and to encompass all of political possibilities. And that it just is always amazing me how a Christian witness undermines any attempt to create a platform, a firm and clear kind of secular politics. It's always asking us to dig deeper and ask harder questions of the secular politics that are presented to us, of whatever sort. And I think those are questions that people who might be aligned with the political right or political left can ask together. You know, what the moment when I decided to go to the church that I go to was when I realized I had a conversation over a beer with the priest and realized that we belong to different political parties. I don't belong to a political party, but we and I don't know about him, but we kind of tended toward different political parties and ends of the apparent political spectrum, but that we could both talk about the kind of Christian questions that were raised by those. And that the fact that we were on different ends of the kind of secular political spectrum didn't mean that we had to question one another's right to be in that church and right to have a Christian conversation about what we hold in common. And you know, too often churches are divided along the lines of secular politics, which I think really harms us.
Absolutely. And I think it is in part because there has been a major innovation in that, in the modern era, the church is kind of pushed away from of political thinking in a kind of deleterious way, because of course people are going to take the ethics that they're formed in the church and apply them to politics, and then the instruction they get from politics is that that's a bad impulse. So even when you hear secular or politicians acting in a secular way, that is acting in a sort of state capacity, talk about their personal ethics versus their political ethics, much of the emphasis is on justifying a discontinuity. So I remember Rand Paul speaking, I think, to medical students, said, sure, Christian physicians have an obligation to treat the sick, but not in a state capacity. He's speaking against, universal health care. So the whole use of Christianity there was to justify a total discontinuity in personal and political ethics. And I think that if you look at it, like you're saying, the Aristotelian frame, of course, politics are just a part of ethics. That of course your personal ethics and your political ethics are going to be of a piece, because they're all just a part of your ethics. And I think that that is the real gem on offer in Christianity, is a personal and political ethic between which there's total continuity. You don't have to sort of put your politics hat on and say, now I'm hard-hearted against the poor or something like that. You never have to do that. In fact, you're explicitly compelled not to. And what you talk about in terms of being able to be involved in a church or to exist as a part of a church with people who disagree on political means, I think is, one of the great gifts of being in a Christian church is that you have good faith between you, that you know that you have the same goals, at least, because you have the same ethics. As to where in the secular political frame, I'm not even sure that some people are wanting good things. I think some people maybe want explicitly bad things. And it makes it very hard to even argue with them, because at the end of the day, you're arguing with them as though they have good goals and maybe they don't. But in the church, and when you're dealing with people who are or sort of sojourning with you, you never have to deal with that kind of paranoia, which is quite nice and I think very healthy for discourse. If there's a space for it in the church.
Well, I'm a little bit less sanguine about drawing such clean lines about people's goodwill in and out of the church. You know, I think often I've learned the most about a Christian witness from people who don't even recognize themselves as Christians, and it's been very difficult sometimes to find examples of that kind of witness in the church. So. I'm glad to hear you've had a better experience, though I'm grateful for so much that happens in church communities, and I hope that they can be better. To me, a big part of what that requires is being willing to really ask hard questions. You talked earlier about your experiences with people deciding not to, deciding to leave the church for particular choices and reasons. I've sometimes found that to be because when they raised questions, when they tried to adjudicate these kind of competing worldviews and figure out where they stood, the church didn't really invite the kind of deep questions that they were asking, and didn't give them good enough answers. I've seen this also in my reporting on evangelical churches. And sometimes it's easier to see more clearly when you get a bit of distance from your own community. But I've been struck by the power of taking young people's questions seriously. When I've been studying these evangelical philosophers who work with often teenagers on their questions about God and science and so forth, and I see them taking questions seriously in a way, in these particular cases, in ways that I often haven't seen in Catholic churches, where the response is more something along the lines of, oh, this is just the doctrine, and if you don't accept it, you're a cafeteria Catholic, or you're not a Catholic at all, and we're just going to draw a hard line, and it's up to you to figure out why this is the teaching. I was really grateful to have a priest and teacher who I was working with in the lead up to my baptism, and who was, my mentor and confessor afterward, who was so good at helping me, at taking my questions seriously and helping me understand not just what the rule is, so to speak, what the doctrine is, but why the doctrine is and what the underlying principles were, so that even if I didn't agree with a particular thing that the church was saying from the Vatican at that moment, or I wasn't sure if I agreed, or I was struggling with my agreement with it, I could at least identify, often with his help, kind of foundational principles that I could recognize as good, that those conclusions were built upon. And so even if I wasn't quite there at the conclusion yet, I could still kind of hold on to the foundational principles, to the ideas behind the conclusions. And that has enabled me to kind of stick with it more easily. And often among the kind of post-Catholic young people I talk with and know and you know, often respect, they didn't get that response. They got a kind of no, or a much more kind of simple and bare and unsatisfying answer, and that's part of why they chose something else.
Right, and I mean I acknowledge that I am not the best person to come to with maybe concerns about the legitimacy of ethics, precisely because the answers that I have as someone who studies theology academically are probably not personally satisfying to people who don't study theology academically. Mm. In a lot of cases, I imagine the sort of hardline doctrinal answers are going to be deeply intellectual. I mean, they're going to have quite a bit of tradition behind them. They're going to be logically very sound, but at the same time, perhaps unsatisfying in a certain way to people who are kind of living in a culture, especially a teenager, where all their friends are saying, there's nothing wrong with X, or X is perfectly fine, or do X if it makes you happy. And then they come to someone and say, hey, what exactly is our rule against X? And they get kind of like a treatise on Aquinas, which is going to be unsatisfying, I imagine, to your average 17-year-old who's feeling isolated.
The people that I'm talking about, you know, are people who where they would be willing, maybe they want to have not just a lecture, but a conversation about Aquinas, that I think maybe what we need to do is think more highly of our young people and provide the resources and the tools for them to really engage with a strenuous presentation of this tradition. And to me, this goes back to the monastic question. You know, it was monasteries that, and the kind of alternative community and radical witness that they represent, that helped bring me into the church, that helped me see a God I could believe in for the first time. And then I got into the church in the midst of the sex abuse crisis at their height, you know, and I realized that so few people around me, so few of the people in the pews around me had ever been to a monastery or even knew that there was a contemplative tradition available to them. They thought the only contemplative tradition they could try out was the Zen meditation, which, you know, was fine, and there's a lot to learn from that, but it was shocking how little their own tradition had been presented to them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that part of what's so great about Pope Francis is that he represents in a lot of ways pieces of the tradition that maybe for some time, to at least your average person in the world, have been less on trend, have been less vocalized. And I recognize that his predecessor obviously had the same doctrine in terms of economics and markets, but the way that Pope Francis has managed mm-hmm. to put them out there, and I'm sure the media has been a huge participant in this just because he's sort of an entertaining character and he's quite a lot of fun to listen to, has managed to reach people in a way that maybe doctrine hadn't before. At the same time, precisely what you're saying is in his apostolic exhortation, he says it's a fact that the same reason the Catholic Church opposes certain things, and I can imagine certain sexual ethical practices or abortion, is the reason that it supports workers, and the reason that it supports the poor, that the foundational ethics are constant, but they're rarely seen that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's been a very, very important part of his ministry, and it's the part that I'm really excited about, is oftentimes the church's no, that's very disappointing to people, is the same voice as the church's yes, which is very enlightening and enlivening to people.
Oh, yeah. And another thing that I think is really makes such a big difference is action. I mean, you're so right in pointing out, and I think we can't stress this enough, that Benedict was, was very clear and very articulate in expressing the social justice tradition of the church, raising environmental issues, for instance, in a way that they hadn't before, talking about global finance, in a very kind of marked and powerful way. But people didn't listen in quite the same way. And I think that goes to the power of symbol and action, and incarnation, you could say theologically, that Francis, he's not changing any doctrine. He's kind of repeating a lot of what Benedict said, but he goes to the big global finance, conferences and articulates this position there. And he washes the feet of the poor and the imprisoned. He goes out as a person into the world in a way that that models very symbolically. He's not changing the world. He's not fixing anything with these actions, but he's putting some flesh onto that teaching. And maybe that's what theologians that's something theologians can learn from too. Is the importance of connecting thought to action and prayer and when you look at, for instance, the lives of the doctors of the church, there's always action involved in those lives. There's always, it's not just thought. There are things that they did, miracles that they performed, as they're told, or kindnesses that they performed that put some flesh onto their ideas in really important ways. And I think, by the way, too, your witness through writing is really important. Your engagement from this kind of deep and rigorous ethical tradition, theological tradition, with the politics going on around us is something that I wish more people with your training were doing. Your columns and blog posts and even tweets are an incredibly valuable resource and to me a really inspiring witness.
Well, thank you so much. And I think that I'm not yet sort of sucked into the academy in a lot of ways because this is something that I'm new to, and I'm new to the Catholic Church. I'm as a convert. I grew up as a Methodist, but studied it for a while before I hopped on board, which I hear Cambridge just does to you. Everybody goes out a Roman Catholic or High Church Anglican, no matter how they come in. In this divinity faculty, it's a little factory. Perhaps people who are deeper in the academy than I am, who've spent more time on it, find it difficult to articulate, as you say, ideas that are so finely nuanced, that are so complicated, and then to kind of marry them with what seem like probably very blunt and very clumsy political realities or political ideologies that they almost seem impossible to bring to union. And it's likely my naivete that allows me to so kind of readily do that. but I'm very happy to be doing it. It's something that that I've really, really grown in my faith through doing. So I really appreciate the opportunity to do it. And I really appreciate you talking with me today about it. So thank you so much.
Oh yeah, I hope this is just the first conversation of many. I've really enjoyed it, and I'll see you on the internet.
All right, see you there.
Okay.
Bye-bye.